Right. With Stephen's help, I have been enhanced. So it's very nice to be enhanced. I hope you can hear me properly. If you can't, let me know, and I'll speak up. I sometimes need slowing down. So when I get excited about topics, I'm Welsh, and I get very Welsh. So if I become too Welsh for you, just let me know, and I'll moderate myself. It's interesting to be back here again. I always love coming here. You're a great group to talk to. This is a lovely room. But one of the things that slightly worries me about some of the times I turn up is I seem to turn up at a time when inexplicable collective events happen. Because I was once here when just after Trump got elected. And here we are again with another strange and inexplicable event. And I think one of the things I want to explore, I'm obviously going to talk about ancient Egypt and its relevance to the modern psyche. But I also, in a way, want to look at how we live in inexplicable times, how we live in difficult times, when our sense of what is decent and true becomes outraged. And how do we do that without making things worse? How do we do that without hating? How do we do that without hating others, hating the world, hating? How do we do that? So my thinking around this lecture started off, I was reading T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, which is a poem I frequently read. And I was just struck, really, by these lines from the beginning of The Wasteland. What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats, and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only, there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of the red rock, and I will show you something different from either. There's lots of meanings to those verses, but one of the things that just struck me, partly because of my current interests and partly because I've been spending a lot of time in Egypt over the last few years, is that when you stand in Luxor, in ancient Thebes, and you look from the east bank to the west bank. The west bank is where all the tombs are. The west bank is the place where the dead live. And it is red rock. It's sandstone. And the sense of going into the shadow of the red rock is an image for me of descent, of going into, of going deep. And in a way, to deal with things like things that have just happened politically, or many of, not just here, but many of the things that are happening in the world, these inexplicable, sometimes terrible things, extraordinary things are going on. Aung San Suu Kyi, the great heroine of Burma, is currently defending the attempted genocide of the Rohingya. How do we make sense of these things? In Brazil, the Bolsonaro is burning the Amazon. You know, it is like the house is on fire. I mean, it's literally on fire. Sydney is wreathed in flames and smoke. So, how do we live in these times? And in a way, when you think of ancient Egypt, it's interesting because we think of it, and it was this incredibly stable civilization. Existed for about 4,000 years. Existed very stably, apparently. Except that there are these times that in Egyptology books are talked about the intermediate periods. You have these dynastic, Egyptology is a way of looking at Egyptian history where it classifies it into the pre-dynastic kingdom, the old kingdom, the new kingdom, the late kingdom. And then there are these little periods, three periods, where they talk, they say, well, these are just the intermediate periods where we don't have much information. If you read the scraps of information that they left from Egyptian writing about these times, that they describe them in rather more vivid ways. Times of chaos, times of despair, times when the ground doesn't give fruit, times when the inundation of the Nile doesn't work. So times really of chaos. And there's a great description of one of these times in a text called The Dialogue of the Man and His Soul. I'll just read that because it just gives us a bit of a flavour of these times. To whom can I talk today? Brothers are barred. Today's friends do not care. To whom can I talk today? Minds are greedy. Every man steals his fellow's belongings. Well, to whom can I talk today? Mercy has perished. Sternness has descended upon everyone. To whom can I talk today? There is contentment with badness, while goodness is cast aside everywhere. To whom can I talk today? He who should enrage another with his barred deed makes everyone laugh with his evil crime. To whom can I talk today? Plunder is rife. Every man robs his fellow. To whom can I talk today? The wrongdoer is a friend, while the close brother has become an enemy. To whom can I talk today? Yesterday is not remembered. No one helps him who gave help then. To whom can I talk today? Brothers are barred. One resorts to strangers for honesty. To whom can I talk today? Faces are blank. Every man's face is downcast against his brothers. To whom can I talk today? Minds are greedy. Nobody's heart can be depended upon. To whom can I talk today? There are no righteous people. The land is abandoned to the unrighteous. To whom can I talk today? Friends are lacking. One resorts to a stranger to complain to. To whom can I talk today? No one is content. The person one used to walk with, he is no more. To whom can I talk today? I am weighed down with misery for want of a friend. To whom can I talk today? Wrongdoing afflicts the land. There is no end to it. It's astonishingly contemporary, that 3,000-year-old poem. You know, as I'm reading it, so it chimes for me with things I'm noticing, things that are affecting me, things that speak to me. And in a way, one of the lines that really stands out for me, or just did then when I was reading it, was this idea that yesterday is not remembered. Because one of the things that deeply worries me, and we have it really in the Eliot poem of "You know only a heap of broken images," where the sense of the matrices of our culture, the sense of history, the sense of cause and effect, the sense of connection with generations that have gone before, is withering, I think, in people's consciousness. And also the very notion of truth itself has become devalued. You know, without making any party political points at all, our new Prime Minister is a man who has a strong record of lying. And this hasn't prevented him in any way achieving highest office in the land. You know, there's just, you know, I'm not doing anything political, it just is known. So there's a sort of astonishing thing there. So the person that we as a nation have chosen to lead us lies. And we do it when we may think that's funny, or some might think that's funny. So there's, and it's interesting in relationship to the idea of ancient Egypt, because one of their central ideas is something called Ma'at, which is the balance of truth. And when they talk about these times of chaos, one of the things that is central to the time of chaos is the abandoning of Ma'at, the abandoning of truth. The In a way that and also this the sense of separating oneself both from history and from community in favor of personal objectives. Now, in Egyptian tradition, there's one particular period that of destruction that arises out of the vision of one man. And his own particular vision of religion, his own particular vision of the world, his own belief in his own rightness. And it's about 1300 BC. It's the rise of Amenhofis IV, who later becomes called Akhenaton. And Akhenaton has this sort of vision. He has this vision of a god, his own personal god, really, called Aton, which is the literal disk of the sun. And Akhenaton does this extraordinary thing of the ancient Egyptian religion was very pluralistic. There's very organized, it's quite a stratified society. But the right at the heart of it was the idea that there are many different visions of divinity, and therefore there's many different gods. You might worship the moon god Thoth, you might worship Isis, you might worship Hathor, and so on. What we find Akhenaton doing is deciding that his vision, his god, is not the only god, there are lots of other gods, but his god is the best god. And his god, in a certain sense, is a jealous god and will have no other gods before him. I seem to have heard that somewhere else. And so he closes the temples, he abandons Thebes, creates a new capital. And the temples in Egypt are also administrative centers. So it would be the equivalent for us of Boris deciding that to close down London as a capital and move the new capital to Wisbech in Finland. If anyone has ever been to Wisbech in Finland, it's a tiny little place in the middle of the Fen. Now the effect of doing that, not only does it have a massive effect upon everybody's spiritual life, because all the temples, all the things that you've relied on, your spirituality gets closed, but it's a bit like having all the town halls closed as well. So that his image, really, Akhenaten's image, is he march off into a bright new future. He sets up this city called Amarna. And which again he finds through vision. He's given a vision by his god, the Aton, that this is the place for the new capital. And basically, I mean, his reign lasts about 20 years, but during those 20 years, there is famine, there is the Egypt's political influence falls apart. There is unprecedented child death from malnutrition and illness. And effectively, the whole thing starts to fall apart. And it's a graphic and powerful image somewhere about how one man's vision, if he has enough power and influence, can cause devastation for many. And obviously, ancient Egypt was a very stratified society. Pharaoh, it was absolute ruler, believed to be the son of the gods, and so we're not fortunately in the same situation. So Boris or anyone who's our prime minister doesn't have that kind of untrammeled power. But it is nonetheless an image of the if one man can dominate others, and if people give their wills to that person and allow that person to lead them, very terrible things can happen. We know this, of course, in our time. And part of the phenomena we see at the moment across the world is the appearance, once again, of strong men. God help us. I mean, not sort of literally, I think, actually. God help us. Now, but what's useful to me about Egypt, about ancient Egypt, and that's why the lessons of history are so important, because actually when we look back into, it's one of the ways of making sense of the inexplicable, of the making sense of chaotic and desperate times, is to learn from other peoples, other societies who have undergone desperate times. And as part of that, the historical consciousness is really needed. So to look back into, so when I look back into ancient Egypt and I look at the total devastation that happened there, I then get interested in, okay, what happens next? And there's a very curious kind of connection between that time in Egyptian tradition and our own. Partly because this is, because the most famous pharaoh of all, whom once again is treasures are in London, happens to be the son of Akhenaten. I'm going to make a really pedantic point, so just forgive me. It's a little obsession of mine. People call this person Tutankhamun. His name is not Tutankhamun. It's Tutankhamun, the living image. Tut means image. Ankh is life. Amun. He is the living image of Amun. Tutankhamun was originally called Tutankhaten, the living image of the Aten. Now, the strange connection, of course, between that time and ours is through the agency of Lord Carnarvon and Howard Carter, who discover the intact tomb of Tutankhamun. And that is responsible for this great consciousness of Egypt that flows really into the 19th century and has just continued ever since. And, you know, it's... And again, it's a small, nothing at all in some ways, but it is an interesting synchronicity for me that here we are, we've got this election time, and Tutankhamun is back in London. And it's just certainly in the way that I'm thinking, maybe nobody else is thinking, but the way I'm thinking, it because I like synchronicity, that the poetic meaning of synchronicity really helps me focus on what I think is emerging. And so it helps me focus on either this time of recovery that the Egyptians were trying to achieve after the total chaos of the 20 odd years of Akhenaten's rule. Now, you know, what happens, what literally happens in ancient Egypt at that time, as the whole Akhenaten thing collapses. Nefertiti, we think, probably rules for a little while, and there's another figure called Sminkare who is in there somewhere, but we don't have good records because this is a time of real kind of chaos. We have the brief reign of Tutankhamun, and then what happens then is there is a dynastic break. Because the next person who takes over is a man called Horemheb, who is a general, and the high priest of Amun at that time take over the country and become responsible for its regeneration. Now, what happens in that time is interesting, really, because this is actually the what arises out of this time of chaos is the beginning of the new kingdom, which is the golden age of Egypt. This is the time of Ramses the Great. This is the time when Egyptian influence spreads right across the Middle East. It's the time of some of their greatest artistic and cultural achievements. And certainly the sense of the country becoming wealthy again, becoming balanced again, becoming a good place to live, a good place to be. But as part of achieving that, what they have to do is to re-envisage, really, and in a sense renew their roots. And one of the things that you see happening there, and is you see a new theology of the god Amun. Now, that's partly because in the 20th, the god Amun is the great creator god of Egypt, Amun-Ra. He's the sun god, but he's also, in his form as Amun-Ra, he is the invisible god. He is the god whose secret image is the image of a human being. So he is the god of generation. And he is and his image is hidden, literally was hidden, in so that people didn't really know what a moon looked like. They knew, often the images that they would show of him was a ram-headed being, but his actual secret image was just the image of a human being. And in the kind of theology that was being kind of generated at that time, they looked really at if the secret image of a moon, who is the generative source, is a human being. The secret image of a human being is also a moon, is the generative source. So one of the things that came into their theology was the idea of the deep creativity of human beings, of the idea that if a human being goes in deeply inside themselves, into the deepest place of themselves, what they find is a profound creative and spiritual energy. But in order to do that, in order to be able to do that, in order to be able to not just touch that, but to bring that out, in order for that sort of living water, in a sense, to irrigate the world, people have to undergo a process that they call becoming ma'at karu. You have to be able to speak with a just voice, a voice of truth. You have to be able to keep faith with that which is true, and keep connected to the living world. How do we do that? It's a really important question today, I think, because the fundamental movement that they're looking at, and it's the, and then symbolically, actually, it's the way the Egyptian temples. I don't know if you've been to Egypt. Egyptian temples are interesting things. They're very elaborate. They're very complicated. But the further in you go, they get smaller. They get more intimate. And right at the heart of an Egyptian temple is a little tiny room. And in the room there is a living image. The image of the Neter, the god, the goddess, who that is the spirit that inhabits the center point. Now, the Egyptian gods, even the word god is complex, really, because we're dealing with a very different civilization. But the Egyptian word for god is Neter, or Neteru. And the image, the hieroglyph for that is a flagpole with a flag blowing in the wind. And so the sense of that center point, that creative thing, is a sense of kind of this pillar that connects heaven and earth, and then has this life, the flag blowing in the wind, that has this breath that brings life. And the process, really, of becoming true of voice is to find the way to go in and down and into the small place, into the place of the beginning. In the beginning is the word, in arche, in Greek, in the Gospel of John. To find the place of the beginning, the small place, the center point, that is somewhere right in the center of your own experience. And there, if you can hang around there, you find this sense of stability, of connecting the height and the depth, and this living breath that can blow into the world, that can help to create and recreate the world. So that's the sort of the vision, really, that starts to arise out of this devastated country at this time when they're trying and beginning to kind of put themselves together. When Jung sits in his study at the end of the day, right at the beginning, when he's working with the black books before he goes into the complexities of alchemy and all the other amazing things he looked at, he does a simple thing. Apparently simple, but powerful in its simplicity. And he sits at his desk, and he imagines himself going inside himself and dropping down down into the deep, down into the depths. And what he does there is powerful, but sort of childlike. It's a power of the kind of simplicity. He's not sort of analyzing himself as he's doing this. An analysis and interpretation happen later. But at the moment of the descent, he is in the descent. He's carrying his senses with him into the depth. And, you know, if you look at the beginning of the Red Book, what you find him describing is landing on squashy ground, looking around him, exploring an inner landscape, talking and communicating to the beings that he finds there. And taking that seriously. You know, as you know, one of the very early things that he finds this image, the image of Salome, the image of his own soul, the blinded and scarred woman who in some ways represents the state of his soul at that particular time. We find he encounters Elijah, the wild prophet, who later becomes Philemon. We find the black snake, who later manifests in all kinds of shadow figures. But the massive literature around Jung's work and all the work that's gone on to then can blind us sometimes to the essential simplicity of that process. And the Egyptian tradition and this point would speak also of the essential nature of that process at times like these. You know, times when we're more tempted to go and kind of try and work out who to kill to get rid of the badness in the world, you know, and kind of actually the counterintuitive thing would be saying, no, don't do that. Come back home, come in, come down, listen to the deep places. One of our problems, of course, is that we're not skilled at this. It's easy to do. Actually, the process of going in and down is not in itself a difficult thing. What is difficult, and where in some ways Jung's genius was just so apparent, was his capacity to sustain that and treat what he found seriously, and believe in the significance, in a sense, of his own soul. And this is an issue, really, I think, that the Egyptians also contemplated. Because partly what was necessary in the act of reconstruction, in the ability to create something that would connect them to their past, that would connect them again to this sense of truth and balance. So they needed a method that would help to encourage them. Help them to sustain their interest, help them to trust what emerges out of the deep, because what emerges out of the deep is always inchoate at first. It's like a murmuring. It's a sort of, you know, you descend inside yourself, you listen to what is there, and it can feel weak and feeble compared to all the things that are happening in the world. Although you might, you know, as we look, it might take heart, really, from a little Swedish girl who decided to sit down outside a parliament, and then, you know, as uncompromisingly followed her truth. You know, she's an uncomfortable, challenging figure for us in some ways. And, you know, we can't. But of course, the danger of people like Greta. Not she's not danger. I think she's extraordinary. But the danger of the image of Greta is that we think we have to be Greta. Greta is Greta. She's being a perfectly Greta. It's a wonderful thing. But the danger whenever we encounter these extraordinary people who are doing extraordinary things is that we forget our own extraordinariness. Because the whole point of some of this stuff the Egyptians were looking at this point is to enable you to find the God in your own heart, the goddess in your own heart, the creative energy that arises specifically from within you, from within your form, from within your approach to life. And in a way, it's interesting. It didn't surprise me at all that this is one of the directions they went in, because they had just had the experience of Akhenaten's vision devastating their whole civilization. So the idea that then actually what you need to do, whatever you're doing in terms of formal worship, you have to find a way to connect individually to something that is deeper than the external religion would give you. You have to find the soul, you have to find the living spirit, the netaru that lives in your own heart. Now, one of the things I think that's particularly interesting for me about Egyptian tradition is its persistence. We find, you know, so this is this mysterious civilization, obscure in a way, very, very obscure until the 19th century because we couldn't read hieroglyphs, but has continued to arise in the collective consciousness of the West. He massively influenced the Greeks and the Neoplatonists. The development of early Christianity happens in the deserts of Egypt. We find it emerging again in the Renaissance. So we find there's something about Egypt that continually emerges, continually calls to us. And in some ways, there's something about the Egyptian capacity to work with the inner and living image. I spent a lot of time the last few years talking with Egyptologists and people who are interested in Egyptology, and I'm this kind of rather weird guy who's interested in depth psychology and kind of, because mostly these guys are interested in history and they're wanting to tell me dates and I'm wanting to understand the meaning of inner images, so we have this interesting conversations, really. But one of the things I found, though, even with these guys who, you know, it's their profession, they're very interested, you can see why they're interested in it for historical senses. At the bottom, there's something about the capacity of the Egyptians to touch depth and to represent a depth in image that speaks to them. And one of the things that I've been looking at, because of course these tombs and things are like time capsules. One of the extraordinary things about these traditions, because nobody knew what hieroglyphs meant until Champollion rediscovers them in the 19th century, they get left alone because they're mysterious, they're magical, but nobody really understands them. And then we start this kind of literature out of the past starts to emerge. And one of the things that starts to emerge is a series of books called the Underworld, the Books of the Underworld, the Books of How to Descend into the Underworld. And the first time we see these, they appear in the tomb of Horemheb, and then in the tomb of Seti I. So they appear right out of this reconstruction, this new theology, this new way of looking at the world. And the Netherworld books, and in particular the Book of Gates, it's a bit like, as far as we can understand, it certainly was used as put in the tombs as a guide for the soul who has died. But they were also used by the living, in order to help them engage in this process of going into depth and becoming Ma'at Karu. And in a certain sense, they're a bit like the spiritual exercises of Ignatius of Loyola. They are books of images that you are intended to immerse yourself in, which help guide your journey into the depths. And one of the great tombs if you ever go to the Valley of the Kings, you get an ordinary ticket, which is but then there's the tomb of Seti I, which is expensive. You have to pay £50 to go in there. But if you're ever there, pay the £50. This is one of the greatest tombs you'll see in the Valley of the Kings. It's incredibly beautifully carved and painted and plastered in high relief. But a large part of this tomb is something called the Book of Gates. And should you not be able to get to Egypt, the other place you can see the Book of Gates is in a museum in London, in the Sir John Soane Museum, which Sir John Soane was one of these sort of European travellers doing the Grand Tour, and he's created this extraordinary museum free museum, you can just go into it, which is it's like a sort of repository of the collective unconscious of the West. It's got images of Greek, Roman time. They're all crammed together. It's a sort of slightly jarring experience. But usefully and appropriately, down in the basement, there is an alabaster sarcophagus taken there by one Belzoni, tomb robber par excellence. And it's an extraordinary thing. It's one of the great treasures of Egypt, of Egyptology. It's an alabaster coffin that has the entire netherworld book of the Book of Gates carved into it. I kind of quite alarmed the staff when I'm there, because people normally have a look at it and pass on. As I like to spend my time reading it, and so I end up circling this kind of coffin time and time again, trying to puzzle it out. But this image of this alabaster sarcophagus it would have been right at the end of Seti's tomb. Now, you never get alabaster is a very precious material in ancient Egypt, and it represents, because it's a transparent stone, it represents the illuminated body. The body, it's a bit like Christ's resurrection body. It's the flesh through which the light is seen. And Seti I, who father of Ramses the Great, was the high priest of Amun before he succeeded Horemheb. And he was somebody who had very much to do with this book of the netherworld called the Book of Gates. And in a sense, by the Book of Gates being wrapped around his body, his mummified body, the statement is being made here: here is somebody who has the voice of truth. Here is somebody that the light shines through his very flesh, who brings blessing and irrigates the burning world. If you're in London, if you're interested in these things, go and see the John Soane Museum and you'll have a look at that. There is Egyptian books are famously kind of expensive, but there is a lovely little book that the St. John Soane's Museum sells called Sir John Soane's Greatest Treasure. And it's a description of the sarcophagus and the Book of Gates, scene by scene. So it's a very inexpensive little kind of way to find an ancient mystical text. Now, what the Book of Gates is a literal guidebook that enables you to make a descent. It's organized around the 12 hours of the night, from sunset to sunrise. And it's a journey in reverse from age to youth. Because it begins with Ra at the end of the day, as Ra is setting, and he's described as weary, in pain, struggling, all the things many of us might feel after difficult election results. Right? That sense of depression, that sense of despair, really. Sense of tiredness, and I just want to stop. And there's some great images of Ra with his walking along with his stick, kind of just about getting there. And in the Book of Gates, Ra, the presence of Ra, is placed in a boat. He is protected by a spiraling serpent. At the prow of his boat is the ability to, it's called a god called Seer, which is the ability to perceive, the ability to pay attention. The back of the boat is Heker, represents magic and will. And in order to renew himself, in order to move from the places of despair, the places of grief, and where I can see no further, he has to then descend through a series of chambers, each one of which is guarded by a serpent. And there's a lot of serpent symbolism in the Book of Gates, and the serpents, as we know, are these very ambivalent symbols. They can be there are good serpents, there are dangerous serpents, there are the serpents that is the serpent that represents the living quality of life. There is a great serpent goddess called Renenutet, who is the goddess of the harvest in Egypt. And you'll see the very beautiful images of a serpent with breasts feeding people, suckling people. So there's this image. So the descent into the depths involves being fed by serpents, engaging with serpents, engaging with that slippery quality of life. Engaging and also engaging with opposition, because the other serpent you find in the Book of Gates is the serpent Apophis, who is the agent of chaos, who is seeking to destroy the world order. And the aim of working with these things is to be fed by the depth, fed by the serpent, restrain, not to kill, but to restrain the energy of chaos, because chaos is also one of the needful energies of the universe, but to create balance. And right at the center of the Book of Gates, there is the fifth hour, which is coming to the deepest place of the night. There is a weighing of the soul scene, which is slightly different from the one you find in the Book of the Dead, where the candidate themselves stands as a living pair of scales before the presence of Osiris, who in this instance is the image of it's the Egyptian image of the green man, of the life that keeps on returning, that dies and returns. And so there's this very beautiful image of the coming together of the presence of Ra in a place of balance, with the encountering the presence that dies and keeps on being reborn. So this experience at the center of ourselves of something dying, but then arising in a new light, a new shape, through finding balance, through confronting difficulty. And the images you find in the Book of Gates are images of, you know, frightening images, peaceful images. In a way, it's the substance of our lives. And it's in a certain sense, what we find is the things that live in our own past, that live inside our own consciousness, but also the collective things. The Donald Trump that lives inside us, the Boris Johnson that lives inside us, the images of genocide, the images of the world burning up. It's to engage with that, to engage with that with presence and persistence, because the whole point of the journey into the night is that you keep going with it. You keep meeting what you meet. You keep being informed by what you meet. And then at this deep point, there is this conjunction of opposites. The sun god and the god who's deep down in the earth. The balancing of the scales, where the opposites are there but are held in a dynamic kind of tension. And what simultaneously happens at that point is an immersion in something they call the Nun, which is the ocean of life. So, and in that immersion, there's a beautiful images of people just being in the waters, being held by the waters and nourished by the waters and resting there until the next moment, which is the beginning of the ascent, where you start to rise. And there's a great image in the book of they personify the images of the waters of the Nun, which is really like the deep unconscious, holding up the bark of Ra and pushing it upwards into the sky so it can be renewed in new life. It's a wonderful image of that, you know, that process when we go inside ourselves, when we go down, when we negotiate with our own inner demons and angels, find peace and rest within, and then that, not us, but a life within us raises us up. And raises us up into the new day, into the new moment. And in a way, that partly is the message really of the ancient Egyptians to us, from thousands of years back, is that the terrible things can happen in the world. Their entire society was completely destroyed, and it can be renewed, but it can only be renewed not by creating more devastation. You renew it by going into the depths. And by listening and trusting that which emerges. And in a certain sense, I think that really is the sort of the lesson of hard times. So it's not about being passive either. Action, of course, is needed, but action from the right place, action that arises not out of hate, but out of a connection with what is true. so that then you speak with Ma'at Karu, you keep faith with the deep, you keep faith with the world. And in that place you are supported by the energy of life itself. This great image of the Egyptian image of the waters of the Nun holding you up, the great, if you like, the great sort of reservoir of life, holding you up into the new day so that the new light manifests in whatever way it needs to manifest. And in that, when we feel that kind of backup, we can be uncompromising in that. Now that is literally the kind of energy that somewhere like Greta Thunberg is tapping. You know, that extraordinary kind of experience of a child deciding to really relating to the kind of the burning up of the world and deciding to go and sit outside a building. You know, it's remarkable. But it's remarkable because she's tapping. You know, this girl has had a lot of attack, really, and people saying that she's a setup. But actually, the only way a human being can do that is because you're supported by the depth. In whatever way she has done that, she has done some version of that. And it isn't that we have to be ancient Egyptian. The ancient Egyptian stuff is helpful, it's useful. But the more important process is that capacity to descend into ourselves and to listen then to what we find underneath. But it's hard to do that because the and why I think we do need things like Egyptian tradition or Greek or whatever helps us to remember the depth that is underneath us. It's why that, you know, Jung spends a lot of his time having explored his own psyche, looking at, well, what can help. So he brings back to our attention things like alchemy, things like ancient myths, and it's interesting, the whole alchemical thing, which we haven't got really time to look at today, sadly, arises out of these ancient Egyptian traditions. Alchemy, it's the Arabic word for the art of Egypt. And in things like the Book of Gates, what you find all the time is a continual experience of having to integrate opposites, to enter the mysterium conjunctio that Jung talks about. And that is the way, and that is the great counterpoint to the energies of splitting that we find all around us in the world at the moment. So this place where we apparently simple task of going inside and traveling through whatever layers need to be traveled through until we find Zeptepi, the beginning place. I'll just end by reading two excerpts, one from Ancient Egypt and one from Four Quartets. So this is a quote from the Book of Gates from the sixth hour of the night. And it talks about people who have become Ma'at Karu, who are able to work with the depth. And it describes them as the gods with the beings with hidden arms. It begins, those with hidden arms who carry the mystery. They carry the mystery of the great God, which many cannot see, but which is seen by the justified dead. When they are burnt in the Benben house, near the place where the God is. Ra says to them, receive my image. Embrace for you your mystery when you rest in the Benben house, near the place where I am. The mystery in which you are is the mystery of the deep. And your Ba-soul belongs to heaven. And having begun with the wasteland, I'm just going to end with the last verse, really, of the four quartets. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started, and to know the place for the first time, through the unknown, remembered gate, when the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning. At the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity. costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one. Thank you very much.
Get together.
Yeah, it'd be lovely. It'd be nice.